Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, December 11th, 2020. Here are some of your headlines. Reports that the White House Chief of Staff told the FDA Commissioner to authorize the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine for emergency use or resign. The U.S. Senate joins the House in passing a one-week federal government extension to avoid a partial government shutdown, while negotiations stall on a coronavirus economic aid package that lawmakers want to attach to a full-year funding bill. Senate also joins the House in passing the annual Defense Policy and Programs Bill, despite President Donald Trump's veto threat. President-elect Joe Biden nominating more cabinet positions, including Congresswoman Marsha Fudge for Housing and Urban Development Secretary, former White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough for Veterans Affairs Secretary, and former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Susan Rice to lead the White House Domestic Policy Council. This as Time magazine chooses Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris as Persons of the Year. We'll talk with a Time senior White House correspondent. And we begin with the coronavirus vaccine from Pfizer, waiting the expected approval by the Food and Drug Administration. President Donald Trump tweeting early Friday, "While my pushing the money-drenched but heavily bureaucratic FDA saved 5 years in the approval of numerous great vaccines, it is still a big old slow turtle. Get the damn vaccines out now, Dr. Han. Stop playing games and start saving lives." The tag was to the FDA Commissioner Stephen Han. Associated Press reports White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows spoke to Han by telephone Friday, according to a senior administration official familiar with the call, and the Chief of Staff telling Han his job was in jeopardy if the emergency use authorization was not issued before Saturday. But Han put out a statement saying this is an untrue representation of the phone call with the Chief of Staff. The FDA was encouraged to continue working expeditiously on the Pfizer-BioNTech EUA request. FDA is committed to issuing this authorization quickly, as we noted in our statement this morning. An FDA advisory committee recommended on Thursday that the FDA okay this Pfizer vaccine. President-elect Joe Biden spoke about this Friday afternoon in Wilmington, Delaware.
"As tough as things are now, I firmly believe better days are ahead. We've got some good news yesterday. The FDA committee recommended emergency use authorization for Pfizer's BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. But we're grateful for the scientists at these, not only there, but other great organizations, researchers who developed this vaccine and several others on the way. And we're just as grateful to the scientists and the public experts who evaluated its safety and efficacy free from political influence. I want to make it clear to the public, you should have confidence in this. There is no political influence. These are first-rate scientists taking their time looking at all of the elements that need to be looked at. Scientific integrity led us to this point. We know the immense challenges and hard work ahead. Earlier this week, I announced our COVID response team that will scale up the manufacturing, distribution, and injection of the vaccine. We set a bold and doable challenge in my first 100 days, 100 million shots in 100 days, asking the American people to wear masks for the first 100 days of our administration. And if we get the necessary funding from Congress, we can get most of our schools open in 100 days, but we need the help from the Congress and the funding. The first 100 days won't end the COVID-19, but meeting those goals can slow the spread, save lives, and get us back to our lives with the people we love the most."
President-elect Joe Biden in Delaware. Between the Pfizer vaccine and another one from Moderna expected to be authorized soon by the FDA, officials project 20 million people in the U.S. could be vaccinated in December. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar gave an update Friday morning on ABC's Good Morning America.
"Well, George, I've got some good news for you here on Good Morning America that just a little bit ago, the FDA informed Pfizer that they do intend to proceed towards an authorization for their vaccine. So in the next couple of days, probably, as we work to negotiate with Pfizer, the information doctors need to prescribe it appropriately, we should be seeing the authorization of this first vaccine. And we'll, as you just said, we will work with Pfizer to get that shipped out. And so we could be seeing people getting vaccinated Monday, Tuesday of next week.
What's left to be done?
So what they do right now, as you had in the good commentary earlier, there was really good discussion at the advisory committee yesterday, especially around issues of these allergic reactions we saw in the United Kingdom. So to put the appropriate language in there that the FDA is considering, also what's called a fact sheet for doctors. That's really an important part of just getting the doctors exactly the information they need so that as they work with their patients, they can make a very informed decision. So it's very close. It's really just the last dotting of I's and crossing of T's.
Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar on ABC this morning. He said that there could be a total of 100 million Americans vaccinated by the end of February. And as this is playing out in Washington, states are preparing for the expected vaccine shipments. In New York today, Governor Andrew Cuomo asked about prioritization of that first batch. You're also going to hear from two of his aides, the state budget director, Robert Mojica, and Larry Schwartz, a former secretary to the governor that Cuomo brought back on.
Governor, you now have Zach Williams from City and State. Zach, your line is now open. Please unmute your microphone.
Hello, Governor. Thank you for taking my question.
Good to be with you, Zach.
You've given a lot of details about your thinking of why nursing home residents and staff should go first with this 140,000 doses that are coming this week. I was just talking to an ambulance driver from Rotterdam earlier today. He wanted to know why ambulance workers specifically were not included in this first delivery. What are your thoughts?
Well, we basically followed the federal guidance, which basically recommended the same thing in their advisory panel. But nursing home residents and nursing home workers, I think almost all across the country, were designated as the first priority, right? If you look at where the virus has spread, where the deaths have spread, all the arrows point to nursing homes first and foremost. Then it goes to healthcare workers and essential workers. The ambulance, let me go to Rob.
Workers across the state are actually in the very front of who gets the vaccine. So you have hospital workers, high-risk hospital workers, and then you have EMS workers. So they are actually in the first 500,000 of doses, which we already have. So we already have, between Moderna and Pfizer, approximately 500,000. The EMS workers across the state will all be in that first 500.
Can we just, Zach mentioned the number 140. Let's get the numbers right. 170,000 from Pfizer, and the Moderna shipment from starting December 21st is 360?
346.
346. Okay, so that's it. So we're roughly over 500,000 doses. And that's the distribution you just... How far down the list will the 500,000 doses get us? Do you know?
Yeah, it'll hospital, high-risk hospital workers, EMS, as Robert pointed out.
And going into
the long-term, the nursing home residents, nursing home staff, the federally qualified health centers are on the list. OPWDD residents and their staff, OMH residents and their staff, medical examiners or healthcare workers, and some OASIS staff will also fall into the healthcare worker definition.
Governor, if you look in the total, there's about 1.5 million in the first tranche, which is all healthcare workers, all congregate care settings, all emergency services workers. It's about 1.5 million, which is the first 1A category. So if you look at it, the 500,000 gets us through a third of that entire section. And by the time they start, which is on the 21st, when we start receiving the nursing homes, we expect to get more vaccine. So those will start to get, we'll get through that first 1.5 million.
News conference in Albany, New York, with Governor Andrew Cuomo, joined by aides Robert Mojica and Larry Schwartz. Governor also said he is considering suing the Trump administration if the allocation of vaccines is not fair for poor or minority communities. And as coronavirus cases continue climbing in New York, Governor Cuomo announcing indoor dining in New York City will be halted starting Monday. Back to Washington, D.C., another week ending without a deal in Congress for another coronavirus economic relief package. Senate party leaders giving an update on what they think is holding things up. Here is the Republican Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell.
Struggling families, exhausted health workers, and anxious small business owners are waiting for the Senate to do what I've tried to accomplish over and over for months. Pass a significant, targeted COVID relief bill built on all the areas where a bipartisan consensus already exists. We know what that common ground looks like. A new second round of the Paycheck Protection Program so hard hit small businesses can keep paying their people. The necessary investments in distribution to get life-saving vaccines out to our people. An extension of some unemployment programs that will otherwise expire in just a matter of days. Republicans have been crystal clear about the sort of urgent and unobjectionable relief we're ready to deliver. I even offered to temporarily set aside one of our side's major requests, common sense legal protections. And by the way, Mr. President, 6,500 lawsuits have already been filed. To set aside common sense legal protections to aid the reopening if Democrats drop their own controversial outstanding demands. But day after day, the Democratic leader finds new reasons not to compromise, new ways to avoid taking yes for an answer. In what universe should emergency aid for small businesses be contingent on massive bailouts for state governments with no linkage to actual needs? Democrats are acting like it's more important to supply the governor of California with a special slush fund than to help restaurant workers in California keep their jobs.
The Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell. The Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, saw things differently.
Why can't we get together? Why can't there be the bipartisanship that Americans search for and yearn for? At a time of such great crisis, there's one reason why America's two major parties have not gotten together during a time of acute national emergency. And that is because the Republican leader has demanded a partisan poison pill, a sweeping corporate liability shield, be included in any legislation, otherwise he won't let it pass. Sounds like an exaggeration, but that's what the leader has said. Quote, he said, "We're not negotiating over liability protection," the leader said on July 28th. Quote, "I'll be responsible for putting the bill final agreement on the floor, and as I said, it will have liability protection in it. We're not negotiating with the Democrats over that." That's the fact. That's the history. There's not equality here. Finally, yesterday, as the bipartisan group of senators and House members were closing in on a final agreement, what happened? Yesterday, the Republican leader's team told the other congressional leaders that the bipartisan group would be unable to satisfy Senate Republicans. Why? Because it might not grant the exact sweeping liability protections for corporations that Leader McConnell has demanded. It's an unconscionable position. No relief for the American people unless corporations receive blanket immunity from lawsuits.
The Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, on the Senate floor. Politico reports in an effort to reach some compromise, committee leaders in both chambers have begun negotiating non-controversial aspects of the relief package, including small business funding, according to three senior aides familiar with the talks. And this is from the Hill newspaper. Senators Lindsey Graham, Republican, and Angus King, Independent, who caucuses with the Democrats, are holding conversations on coronavirus liability protections for businesses and other organizations in an attempt to find common ground where other senators have failed. The plan was to attach any coronavirus aid bill that's reached, any deal that's reached, to the regular federal government spending bill. The current authorization for that spending expired today. The House had passed a one-week extension earlier this week, and today the Senate did as well by voice vote. That will allow President Trump to sign it into law. But they didn't pass it before two senators spoke about an amendment that they wanted to offer. it would provide another round of stimulus checks to the American people. Those senators are Bernie Sanders, the other independent who caucuses with the Democrats, and Josh Hawley, a Republican. Here is Senator Hawley on the floor.
If the Senate of the United States can find hundreds of billions of dollars to give to big government and big business, surely it can find some relief for working families and working individuals. And I would just submit to you that it is working families and working people who should be first in line for COVID relief, not last. And that is why the amendment that Senator Sanders and I have proposed is so common sense. $1,200 for individuals, $2,400 for families, $500 for every child. And as Senator Sanders rightly says, every member of this body has voted yes in favor of this relief before. What's more, I can't figure out who exactly is opposed to it. The President of the United States has said that he is in favor of direct assistance.
Senator Josh Hawley on the Senate floor. He and Senator Sanders did not object to the passage by voice vote of that one-week extension of federal government funding, and they did withdraw that amendment. On Wall Street today, the Dow was up 47, NASDAQ down 27, S&P down 4. The Senate today also passing the annual Defense Policy and Programs Bill in face of a presidential veto threat. It's called the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act. Senator James Inhofe, Republican, chairs the Armed Services Committee, spoke before the vote.
You know, I know there's a lot of controversy about this bill. I know that the president wanted to have something in there that was on having to do with language that had nothing to do with the military, and I agree wholeheartedly with him. But you can't, you've got to have a defense authorization bill. Our kids in the field demand it. And with the NDAA, we're implementing the policies and programs to make sure that this doesn't happen. We ensure that America is able to prevent and, if necessary, win wars of today and tomorrow.
Senator James Inhofe on the Senate floor. The Senate passed the NDAA, $740 billion for the fiscal year, by a vote of 84 to 13. Both the Senate vote today and the House vote on the defense bill earlier this week were by margins that would be enough to override the promised presidential veto. The president objects to the bill because it requires the renaming of military bases named after Confederates, and the bill does not contain a limit on social media company liability. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. President-elect Joe Biden continues to roll out his choices to lead departments, agencies, and White House offices. From Wilmington, Delaware, today's nominations included Democratic Congresswoman Marsha Fudge of Ohio for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
I remember the feeling I had as a kid of the safety, security, and peace of mind contained in one word, home. I remember the comfort of knowing that no matter what happened, I could always go home. But far too many Americans live without that feeling. More and more have had that comfort ripped away. The crisis of a pandemic that has threatened their lives, the crisis of a recession that has swallowed up jobs, hours, wages, and lifelines, the crisis of injustice that has forced communities of color to make it in America with one dream tied behind their back. Each crisis chips away at their hope, at the promise of our nation. But I believe that hope is on the way, because I know that President-elect and Vice President-elect are building a team that is grounded in dignity. And our task at the Department of Housing and Urban Development will be to stand up for the dignity of all Americans and deliver the promise of our nation to all those left out in the cold. We will take on the deep-set roots of poverty and homelessness. We will fight for housing in every community that is affordable, decent, and safe. We will help more Americans secure the dream of home ownership, to close the gaps of inequity, build wealth, and pass it on to their children. We will pursue creative development projects to shape our landscapes and skylines, restart the engines of cities that have stalled out, and launch new opportunities in hometowns across America. But perhaps most importantly of all, we will help people believe once again that their government cares about them, no matter who they are, that we understand their problems.
HUD Secretary nominee Marsha Fudge. A number of progressive groups publicly called for Congresswoman Fudge to be nominated for Agriculture Secretary. One of those groups, the Sunrise Movement, said her being passed over was due to, quote, shallow racial stereotypes about the office. Congresswoman Fudge is black. Instead, today, President-elect Joe Biden nominated Tom Vilsack for Ag Secretary. Vilsack served in that same post under the Obama administration. Other nominees today, Dennis McDonough, former Chief of Staff to President Obama, for Veterans Affairs Secretary, Katherine Tai for U.S. Trade Representative, and to head the White House Domestic Policy Council, another veteran of the Obama administration, former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice.
Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's vision for our future is expansive but achievable. America must finally become a nation where every child, from Akron to Arkansas, from the Bronx to Brownsville, from the Sioux Nation to South Central Los Angeles, can dream without limits and make her dreams come true. I have no illusions about the difficulty of making that vision real, but we are here to get hard stuff done. Our top priorities will be to help end the pandemic and revitalize the economy so that it delivers for all, to bring dignity and humanity to our broken immigration system, to advance racial equity, justice, and civil rights for all, to ensure that health care is accessible and affordable, and to educate and train Americans to compete and thrive in the 21st century. I profoundly believe that we all rise or fall together, absolutely all of us.
Susan Rice appointed to head the Domestic Policy Council in the Biden administration. President-elect Biden, when introducing today's nominees in Delaware, noted that many do have prior experience in the executive branch.
Vice President-elect Harris and I knew we'd have our work cut out for us when we got elected, but we also knew we could build a team that would meet this unique and challenging moment in American history. Some are familiar faces. Some are new in their roles. All are facing new circumstances and challenges. That's a good thing. They bring deep experience and bold new thinking. Above all, they know how government should and can work for all Americans.
President-elect Joe Biden today in Wilmington, Delaware. Time has named him and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris as their Persons of the Year. And joining us now with more on this selection is Time's senior White House correspondent Brian Bennett. Thanks for being with us. Your editor-in-chief wrote that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are being recognized for changing the American story, for showing that the forces of empathy are greater than the furies of division, for sharing a vision of healing in a grieving world. Can you elaborate on that for us?
So every year, Time chooses the Person of the Year, and this year was a particularly difficult year for everyone living through it in 2020. And there were a lot of discussions about how to capture that in our Person of the Year issue and who should be on the cover. We looked at Donald Trump, for example, who had a big influence on the news for the year. We looked, of course, first responders and nurses and the racial justice movement. And we really came down to the ticket that won the presidential election at a time of division. You had Joe Biden and Kamala Harris coming together on a message of unity and healing for the country to try to bring the country through this difficult time, and decided that those two should be named Person of the Year. We also recognized Guardians of the Year this year. So we profiled Anthony Fauci and racial justice protesters like Portia Bennett Bay in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and Asa Traoré in France, who along with many, many, many others, led these powerful marches in the streets that brought the country to a moment of reckoning with systemic racism.
Interesting that they're both named, and it's the union, almost suggesting that if they didn't have each other, they may not have gotten your nod.
We definitely talked about this, and we felt like the ticket was the story of the year, that it would have been very hard for Biden to win without Harris, and that bringing Harris on was able to send that message and bring together the coalition that they needed to win, that he could not have done it without her on the ticket. It's also the first time that Time Magazine has put a vice president on the cover for the Person of the Year issue. And that notion of having the two of them together was something that we felt like really captured the moment, having the nation having gone through this divisive year, the election result being so decisive with them winning over 7 million votes more than Trump and flipping five battleground states that Trump had won before in their favor. That really is the duo of the two of them that captured the moment of the year.
Now, Donald Trump was Time Person of the Year when he won in 2016. Now, 4 years later, the people that beat him win. What do you make of that?
So certainly Donald Trump's rise and as a political force was something that we marked with many, many covers. And there's no doubt about Trump's influence on the American political landscape. He transformed the Republican Party, made it more focused on a party of personality, focused on him, which he's trying to ride out as he makes these efforts to overturn the result of the election. Time Magazine is always kind of like a clock. It takes the cover represents moments in certain periods of time. And when President Trump was elected, that was an important moment to mark, putting him on the cover and about the forces that he was bringing, political forces that he was bringing to the fore. And now we're in a new era, and we're going to have to see what Biden and Harris do with the presidency and how they bring the country out of this really divisive time, and whether they can actually deliver on this promise of unity that they campaigned on.
We're talking with Brian Bennett from Time. Tell us about the selection process. Who does the nominations? How many are on the table? And who is on the committee that selects the winner? And take us into the room, what it's like there.
So there's a handful of editors that are run the process inside the magazine. We have talks that start a few months before the selection is made, started late in the early fall. Ideas are brought in from the entire newsroom. The first meeting was an all-hands meeting to discuss the main topics. There were more than 100 ideas that we started with. And then a group of editors winnows that down and starts to think about what are the big themes of the year. Ultimately, it's the editor-in-chief, Edward Felsenthal's decision of what goes on the cover, what is going to be the Person of the Year. And then they also make selections for people who had big influence in other areas. So there was an Entertainer of the Year, who was BTS, the pop band. And there's the Athlete of the Year, LeBron James, for not only what he did on the court, but also his activism for Black lives and racial justice and voting, trying to get more access for voting off the court that he did. And then we also recognized a category of Guardians of the Year, people who really stepped forward to protect us, protect people who were subject to racial discrimination, so activists who had helped lead racial justice marches, as well as Dr. Fauci was recognized as a guardian for standing up for science and good medical practices during the pandemic, as well as frontline medical workers.
Read more at time.com, Person of the Year, and the other categories. Time Senior White House Correspondent Brian Bennett. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
President Donald Trump tweeting today, if the Supreme Court shows great wisdom and courage, the American people will win perhaps the most important case in history, and our electoral process will be respected again. President referring to a lawsuit led by Texas, joined by 17 other states, seeking to have election results in key states won by Joe Biden thrown out in favor of giving those electoral college votes to Donald Trump. Today, the governor of one of those states, Pete Ricketts of Nebraska, was asked about the case.
So the question is, I'm a big states' rights guy. What would I think if another state challenged our election laws? We're not challenging their election laws. We're challenging their process. What we're saying is, hey, if you're not following the process of changing your laws through the legislative branch, that's the appropriate constitutional way to do it. You have to do that just like everybody else does. Every state has to follow that, unless you have a law that allows something for different. You can't just make up laws in the executive branch. You can't make up the laws in the judicial branch. Certainly, this is one of the things that we talk about a lot is judicial activism. You cannot legislate from the bench. So we discourage that from our judicial branch, but you've also got to discourage it from the executive branch. There's been many cases as we've gone through this pandemic, we've talked about, can the governor's office do this? And the attorney general's advised, no, you can't do that. You can, because that you don't have the ability to, create a new law or whatever. You can waive a statute that maybe allows for somebody to do something, but you can't, do something else. You've got to act within the laws or the Emergency Management Act as they are written. And so that's true for Nebraska. It's true for everybody else. So if we were not, if we were acting outside of our prerogatives, I would hope that actually before some other state, brings it up, that somebody here in Nebraska would be doing, be saying, hey, you gotta follow the law.
Why isn't this just a political move for Republicans? Explain it.
So again, Andrew's saying, why is this not just a political move for Republicans? I think the separation of powers is a profoundly held belief in this country and is important to our very republic and the foundation of our country that we follow the rule of law and we have the separation of powers. That's not a political stunt. That is the foundation of our republic.
Governor Pete Ricketts, a Republican, during a news conference in Lincoln, Nebraska. Here in Washington on the Senate floor, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut chastised Republican lawmakers, both the state and federal level, for backing this lawsuit.
This lawsuit is supported by 106 House Republicans. That's more than half of the Republicans who serve in the House of Representatives. It is supported, apparently, by many Senate Republicans as well. This lawsuit is an attempt to overthrow democracy. Now, you can laugh at it, you can scoff at it, you can suggest that it has no chance to prevail if it reaches the 9 Supreme Court justices. But let's be clear about what it argues. And let's be clear about the consequences for so many elected officials at the highest level of American government supporting this lawsuit. What it argues is that the votes in four states, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, and Michigan, should be thrown out because Trump didn't win. And it asks for the state legislatures controlled by Republicans to appoint electors instead. Now, there are a bunch of vague, unsourced claims about voter fraud in this lawsuit, but there's not a shred of evidence for these claims. And all of the individual lawsuits trying to allege voter fraud, trying to create contests about how laws were modified regarding voting in these states, have all lost.
Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, on the Senate floor. Another 20 House Republicans joined on today to the lawsuit, including the Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Senator Murphy mentioning that Senate Republicans may be supporting this, but it might be notable that not one Republican senator has officially signed on to a friend of the court brief in this lawsuit to the Supreme Court. In Wisconsin today, a judge rejecting President Trump's challenge to that state's recount and affirming Wisconsin's certified results showing President-elect Joe Biden won the state by more than 20,600 votes. The case expected to be appealed to Wisconsin's Supreme Court. This all comes ahead of Monday when the Electoral College is meeting. Join C-SPAN starting at 10 a.m. Eastern as we take you to state capitals around the country as electors cast their votes to formalize the election of Joe Biden as the nation's 46th president. And thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Get the free C-SPAN radio app to listen anywhere. And remember, this program is available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts. Hope you have a good night and weekend. See you Monday.